All right, this morning we're going to talk about being a victim. Everybody's a victim nowadays. You know, they're a victim of, you know, somebody else's misbehavior. They're a victim of somebody's accident. Everybody's a victim. However, that all aside, there are legitimate areas where people are legitimately victims. A wife who gets abandoned by her husband. A child who's neglected and molested, an employee who is surrounded by slander and rumor. There are legitimate areas of being a victim. A story is told about a husband who went out one morning to get in his car and it wouldn't start. So in typical fashion, because we're men, we always lift the hood, not because we know what we're doing, but because that's what you do. You just lift the hood. Well, he lifted the hood and looked under there and there was no battery. Well, obviously the car's not going to start without a battery, but there's a note where the battery usually is. And the note said something to the effect of, "I really apologize. I had to get my wife to the hospital. My car wouldn't start. I took your battery. I'll return it later." So he thought, okay. Later that afternoon, the battery was returned, placed in the car with another note. "I want to thank you so much for the use of your battery. I'm sorry for any inconvenience I've made, have placed upon you. And so here's my compensation." And he left him two tickets to Texas Stadium to go see the Cowboys. Now, that may not be something that everybody wants nowadays, but in this case, these were avid Cowboy fans, and they really appreciated the opportunity to go to the game and to be a part of that. So they go to the game the following Sunday afternoon, come home, and find that their house has been burglarized. The tickets were designed to get them out of the house so that the people could break in and steal what they had. Talk about being a victim, huh? If anybody knew about being a victim and experiencing unfair treatment, it's Joseph. First, he received unfair treatment from his family. His brothers hated him just because he was his dad's favorite. Next, his circumstances placed him as a slave in a land where he didn't know the language. Then he gets falsely accused of a crime. He's put in prison, and he's abandoned. And that's where we find Joseph this morning as we look in Genesis chapter 40. How Joseph dealt with his unfair treatment gives us some clues for ourselves as we deal with it today. Because the reality of life is that all of us have experienced some form of unfair treatment. Someone less deserving than you, or who didn't work as hard, doesn't have the same education, got the promotion, and you didn't. Or got the part in the school play that you had rehearsed and planned and thought you had had, and it was given to somebody else because the teacher liked them better. You worked hard. You were promised a raise, but it never came. Your spouse walked out on you for whatever reason. A good friend promised to help but never showed up and didn't seem to care. And you can add to that list, right, where you have felt that you have been treated unfairly. So what do we do? How do we respond as followers of Christ? How do we respond to that? And I believe that Joseph gives us some hints. So we're going to look at the story, a story you probably know fairly well. But from the story, we're going to make some application. So turn, if you will, in your Bibles to Genesis chapter 40. I'm going to start by reading the first four verses. "It came about after these things that the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was furious with his two officials, the chief cupbearer and the chief baker. So he put them in confinement in the house of the captain of the bodyguard in the prison, the same place where Joseph was imprisoned. And the captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them, and he took care of them, and they were in confinement for some time." Before we get to the actual guards, the guests, if you will, themselves, let's simply review why Joseph was in prison in the first place and also try to determine how long he had actually been there. Joseph had been accused by Potiphar's wife of attempting to rape her. And so she accuses him of that. Now, if Joseph had been an Egyptian citizen and someone in authority had accused him of that crime, whether he did it or not wouldn't have mattered. He would have been put to death. Joseph, however, is not put to death. Joseph is put into prison. Remember, Joseph was in Potiphar's house, and Potiphar so respected Joseph that he had given him authority over everything in his house except for his wife. So Potiphar had an incredible amount of respect for Joseph, and one wonders perhaps if this was the best that Potiphar could do for Joseph, is to put him in a place where he might be somewhat safe, and while he might have life in prison, from Potiphar's perspective, that might be better than death. And so he's put in prison for a crime he didn't commit. And the only way he'd ever get out of there was if Pharaoh commuted his sentence. Joseph didn't know Pharaoh. That didn't seem likely. How long had Joseph been in prison? Now, the text doesn't say exactly, but let's make some inferences from what we do know to kind of get a better picture of where Joseph was and what was happening. Chapter 37, verse 2, tells us that when Joseph was sold into slavery, he was 17 years old. Look at Genesis chapter 37, verse 2. These are the records of the generations of Jacob. Joseph, when he was 17 years of age, was pasturing the flock with his brothers while he was still a youth, along with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. So he's 17 years old when he's sold to the Ishmaelites and then arrives in Egypt and is sold to Potiphar. So 17 or 18 years old when he arrives in Egypt. According to Genesis chapter 41, so we're skipping ahead now, and verse 46, when Joseph finally did stand before Pharaoh, he's now 30. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood in the presence of Pharaoh, king of Egypt. So 17 years old when he sold into slavery to Potiphar, 30 when he finally stands before Pharaoh. We're going to get to that.
Okay.
That's it. Thank you for the segue. I appreciate that. What we know for sure is 13 years passed from the time he was sold or he arrived in Egypt till he stood before Pharaoh. We know from chapter 41 and verse 1 that 2 years passed from the time the cupbearer and the baker left. You know, he had interpreted their dreams, first chapter 41. It happened at the end of 2 full years that Pharaoh had a dream. So the cupbearer and the baker have their dreams. Joseph interprets them. They leave, and Joseph spends 2 more years in prison. So the minimum time that Joseph was in prison was a little over 2 years. However, how long reasonably was it before Potiphar's wife would have taken an inkling to Joseph as he was in the household? Because Joseph had been given authority over everything that Potiphar owned. Would it take a year? Would it take 2 years? We don't know because the text doesn't say exactly. But Joseph was handsome. We know that. He was probably quite calm in his demeanor, a very likable person, because he was given all of this authority and responsibility. So Joseph refused her advances, and it's likely, at least in my opinion, that that would have taken no more than 3 years, and most likely 2 at the most, that he would have been in Potiphar's house. And if that's the case, then Joseph was imprisoned about the age of 20, 21. And again, we don't know. That's not a fact. But the inferences from Scripture seem to imply that. And so he spent 7 or 8 years in prison before the cupbearer and the chief baker were arrested. So think about this. Joseph was imprisoned with a life sentence at about age 20. At about 28, his hopes are raised because he interprets the cupbearer's dream, who's going to be returned to favor, and so he's going to be blessed, and he asks the cupbearer to remember him and get him out of this prison. But then the cupbearer forgot him. So time goes by, 1 year, 2 years. He languishes in prison. I mean, put yourself in Joseph's sandals. How would you feel if at age 20 you had been falsely accused? At age 17, you'd been sold into slavery by your brothers. Now you're imprisoned without a trial. You're given a life sentence. Your hopes get raised by the possibility of someone acting as your advocate, only to be forgotten and left in prison in Egypt, a place that Joseph called a dungeon. Talk about unfair. He had yet to do anything wrong to be treated like that. Yet despite being treated unfairly and finding himself in a quite hopeless, helpless situation, Joseph remained faithful to God. He trusted in God's promises, and we'll see also that he served others. And I think each one of those principles, I'm kind of telling you where I'm going with this, each one of these principles gives us hints as to how we handle unfair treatment today.
Jeff?
Yes?
Have you made any inferences about how old Potiphar was as compared to Pharaoh? And maybe Potiphar was looking to become Pharaoh.
No, I didn't make that inference. My inference was, I wonder if Potiphar suspected that his wife wasn't telling the whole truth to begin with.
I agree with that.
But you don't, those are things we don't know. You're just kind of looking at the text and saying, okay, what are likely scenarios that could have played out? Rocky?
It's clear that there wasn't a pathway to kingship from Potiphar.
Okay. Joseph could not have known when all these bad things were taking place that God was always at work preparing him for something special. Now, he knew he had a dream, right? That his brothers were going to serve him. But you have to wonder, after 7 and 8 years in prison, how in the world is that going to happen? I mean, from the human side, Joseph's suffering was due to injustice on the part of Potiphar's wife and maybe even Potiphar, ingratitude on the part of the cupbearer. Yet from the divine side, from the providential hand of God, these things were permitted for Joseph's training, for equipping him for the task and the work that lay ahead. I mean, if you and I only look at the human side when bad things happen to us, when unfair treatment comes, we will be discouraged. We will become angry. We might even become embittered. And we might even walk away. But if we look at it from the divine side and rest in the fact that we know that God is sovereign and we know that God is good, that's what we know in our heads, then we can be faithful to God in our circumstances. Or let me put it another way. Our theology and our understanding of the providence of God, of the sovereignty of God, of the goodness of God are crucial to how well we deal with unfair treatment today. Or if I can make it even a smaller statement, theology matters. What you believe matters because it impacts the way that we live. Back to the story. After 7 or 8 years of imprisonment, where even Joseph was prospering, because I want you to go back to chapter 39. Verse 20, Joseph's master took him and put him into prison, the place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in the prison. But the Lord was with Joseph and extended kindness to him and gave him favor in the sight of the warden of the prison. And the warden of the prison put Joseph in charge of all the prisoners who were in the prison, so that whatever was done there, he's responsible for it. The warden of the prison did not supervise anything under Joseph's authority because the Lord was with him. And the Lord made whatever he did prosper. So here's Joseph confined in prison. And in verse 11, Joseph called this a dungeon. So it's not like he has free rein in the upper story of the house and he can kind of come and go. He's in prison. But in prison, he becomes second in command to the warden now. Now remember, in Potiphar's house, he's second in command to Potiphar. Now in prison, he's second in command to the warden. He's responsible for all of the prisoners. So if one falls ill, he's got to figure out what to do. If one needs food, he's got to figure out what to do. If one is complaining about, you know, his cell isn't comfortable, he's got to figure out what to do. He's responsible for everything that happens in the prison. On a particular day, after 7 or 8 years of this, the cupbearer and the baker, who were responsible for the Pharaoh's drink and food, are incarcerated with him. We know more about cupbearing from the story of Nehemiah, who was the cupbearer to the king, and we know Nehemiah's story. But here's an unnamed cupbearer to Pharaoh. He was one of the most trusted men in the court. He was the man who chose the wine for the king. And then he would taste it. So if he keeled over, the king wouldn't drink it. He made sure it not only tasted good, but that it wasn't poison. And then he would place the cup in which he had poured the wine into the hand of Pharaoh. The chief baker was the person responsible for the food that the king ate. He would set before the king the meals. The cupbearer would set before the king his wine. Both these men had direct access to Pharaoh every day. In a very real sense, they were one of the most influential men in the court of the Pharaoh. And for unspecified reasons in the text, the cupbearer and the baker ended up in prison. Whatever it was that they did, notice how the text phrases it in verse 2. Pharaoh was furious. The word literally means to be enraged, full of wrath. Now, we don't know what they did specifically, but the chief baker, the chief cupbearer, and the chief baker said they were put in confinement in the prison of the captain of the guard. And if you look at verse 1, it says, the cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt offended their lord. The word is literally sinned against. They so offended him that from Pharaoh's perspective, it was a sin. Now, I have no idea what that would have been. Didn't show up on time. You know, didn't get the right wine or prepare the right meal. Or neglected to do something they were supposed to do. Were given a command they didn't follow through on. It doesn't really matter what they did. What we need to know is it so enraged the Pharaoh that he took both of these men and he threw them in prison. And lo and behold, it's the same prison in which Joseph is incarcerated. And notice what it says at the beginning of verse 4. The captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them and he took care of them. You know what that phrase, took care of, means? He served as a personal attendant to them. He ministered to them. It's the same word that's used of the ministry of Aaron in Exodus chapter 28. It's the same word that's used of the ministry of the Levites in Deuteronomy chapter 10. It's the same word that's used of the priest in 1 Kings chapter 8. So his task was more than a menial task of making sure that they had a robe and a bed. He ministered to them. He really cared for them. He demonstrated kindness to them. And notice they were in the house of the captain of the bodyguard. Who's that? Chapter 39, verse 1. Joseph had been taken to Egypt, and Potiphar, an Egyptian officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the bodyguard. So they're in the dungeon that's in the basement of Potiphar's house. Or next door. I mean, Potiphar's responsible for the dungeon. He puts Joseph in charge of the people who are in the dungeon. Joseph, who had been a slave in Potiphar's house and given authority there, is now in prison, again run by Potiphar, and is given authority there. And as I said earlier, just a second, I wonder if Potiphar was suspicious of the accusation that his wife made against Joseph in the first place. Rob?
Might the captain of the bodyguard be a different person than Potiphar by this point in time?
I suppose that's possible. I don't think so. Simply because he's given that title in chapter 39, and we know it was Potiphar who gave him the authority in prison, and it makes sense that the same words would be used in reference to the same person. So, an unspecified period of time passes after they're incarcerated. And on a particular night, both the cupbearer and the baker have dreams. Look at verse 5. The cupbearer and the baker for the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, both had a dream the same night. Each man with his own dream, and each dream with its own interpretation. Now, culturally, Egyptians, Babylonians as well, regarded dreams, specific dreams, as having very significant impact upon their lives. There were men who learned the technique of how to interpret dreams. Now, I don't know how they did that, but I know that historically that was true. Dreams were considered the vehicle of divine revelation. Had they been in Pharaoh's court, they would have had access to someone who could interpret their dreams. But in prison, they had no such access. And because of that, they were saddened. It changed their countenance. Notice what the text says, verse 6. When Joseph came to them in the morning and saw them, behold, they were dejected. They looked so sad, so downtrodden, that there was a difference in their appearance. So he asked Pharaoh's officials, who were with him in confinement in his master's house, why are you so sad today? Why are you so upset? And notice what they said. We have had a dream, and there is no one to interpret it. They weren't upset because they had a dream. They were upset because there was no one to interpret the dream.
Did they each have the same dream?
No, we'll find out there is similarities but differences. They happened on the same night, but the text reminds us each his own dream, each his dream with its own interpretation. Little did they know that they had the dreamer of all dreams sitting right next to them. So Joseph engages them in a conversation. And immediately, Joseph references Yahweh. He says in verse 8, Joseph says to them, do interpretations not belong to God? Dreams are not the privilege of humans, but the domain of God, specifically in reference to their interpretation. Interpretations come from God. The implication in that statement seems to be that God will interpret their dreams. If they'll tell Joseph, he will interpret them for him. Now remember, Joseph had been ministering to them in some form or fashion, showing care and concern for who they were while they were in prison. Joseph had developed a reputation where he could be trusted He developed a reputation where he was a man of character. And so when Joseph references the fact that interpretations of dreams can come from God and says, if you'll tell me, because of the reputation that he had, they're going to assume that Joseph can interpret the dream. I suspect they knew that Joseph cared enough not to lie to them, but to tell them the truth. So first we have the cupbearer's dream. Verse 9. The chief cupbearer told the dream of Joseph. Listen to the dream. In my dream, behold, there was a vine in front of me. On the vine were three branches. And as it was budding, its blossoms came out, its clusters produced ripe grapes. Now Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, so I took the grapes. I squeezed them into Pharaoh's cup. I put the cup into Pharaoh's hand. Then Joseph said to him, this is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your office. And you will put Pharaoh's cup into his hand as in your former practice when you were his cupbearer. Only keep me in mind when it goes well for you. And please do me a kindness by mentioning me to Pharaoh and get me out of this prison, this dungeon. For I was in fact kidnapped from the land of the Hebrews, and even here I have done nothing that should have put me into this dungeon. The central element of the cupbearer's dream is the vine. Now, would that be surprising for a cupbearer? Well, of course not. No. His responsibility was to care for the grapes and produce the wine and give it to the king. The imagery in the dream is one of abundance. And you may have noticed that there are groups of three. There are three branches in the dream. The branches budded, blossomed, and ripened, three different words. There are three activities that the cupbearer did. He took them, he squeezed them, and he placed them into Pharaoh's hand. And interestingly enough, there are three mentions of Pharaoh and three mentions of the cup. One might say that three had a significant number both to the Egyptians as well as to the Hebrews, because it's meant three things. Joseph, without hesitation, gives the interpretation. Three branches or 3 days. And that at the end of those 3 days, your head will be lifted up. Means you're going to be, the king's going to deal kindly with you. You're going to be restored to your position. And as a result of that interpretation, Joseph makes an appeal for himself to remedy his unjust treatment. Throughout the narrative, matter of fact, from the time Joseph is sold into slavery until now, Joseph is unusually silent about his condition. You don't find Joseph complaining. You don't find Joseph muttering. You don't even find Joseph praying about it in any form or fashion, at least as the text records it for us. Perhaps Joseph knew that God was at work in some form or fashion, but we get a hint as to how Joseph felt about his situation by virtue of his appeal that he makes to the cupbearer. Joseph is so certain of the interpretation that he says, when it is well with you, not if it turns out that I guessed right and something good happens to you, let me know. Joseph is certain because he knows his interpretation is not a guess. And so he says very strongly to the cupbearer, remember me and mention me. That phrase, remember me and mention me, are the same Hebrew word, just different tenses. Why? Because to remember means to act on someone's behalf. So when God remembers his covenant with the nation of Israel, he acts on their behalf. It's not just that God one day went, oh yeah, I remember I did that. That's a good idea. He acted on their behalf. So Joseph says to the cupbearer, remember me and do that by mentioning me to the Pharaoh. That's how you will know that the cupbearer remembered him, because he acted on his behalf. He mentioned him. It's not that he forgot in terms of no recollection, but in the end he chose not to act. But here in verse 13, Joseph is asking him to act on his behalf and specifically remember, mention, and then he says, show kindness to me in verse 13. You know what that Hebrew word is? The Hebrew word hesed. Show some covenant loyal love to me. I have cared for you here. Demonstrate that you care for me out there. Show kindness to me. Get me out of here because I don't belong in this place. I don't really belong in Egypt because I was sold into slavery, and I definitely don't belong in this dungeon. And I've dealt kindly with you. So if you would deal kindly with me, you would speak to Pharaoh and explain to him what happened and get me out. Now, the baker, probably listening to the conversation, thinks, oh, this is great. Let me see what my dream means. Verse 16. Chief baker saw that he had interpreted favorably. He said to Joseph, I also saw in my dream, and behold, there were three baskets of white bread on my head. And in the top basket, there were some of all kinds of baked food for Pharaoh. And the birds were eating them out of the basket on my head. Uh-oh is right. Then Joseph answered and said, this is the interpretation. The three baskets are 3 days. So far, so good. Within 3 more days, Pharaoh will lift up your head. Same phrase when he said to the cupbearer, lift up your head. But then he adds, from you. And will hang you on a wooden post. And the birds will eat your flesh off of you. Both dreams are dominated by the number 3 days. In the case of the baker, there are 3 baskets. Both dreams depict them returning to the face of the Pharaoh, but there's one significant difference in the dream of the baker compared to the dream of the cupbearer.
And Joseph didn't say, if I'm wrong, remember me.
He did not say that, right? One has to wonder, maybe not one of you, but me. Joseph knew by the interpretation of the dream that the baker was doomed. But since he knew he was doomed, why didn't he just tell him something else? Because by the time the baker figured it out, it wouldn't have mattered. I mean, he could have told him, 3 days you're going to be restored. Those 3 baskets are going to be given to Pharaoh. He's going to restore you to a position. The baker would have never known the difference, and he couldn't have gotten back at Joseph after he was decapitated anyway.
Yeah, but a good Christian can't.
Right. And that's the point, I think, of the character of Joseph. He was going to tell the truth, regardless of the consequences that might come. And again, you look at the 2 dreams, the cupbearer managed the task of picking the grapes and squeezing them and presenting the finished product to Pharaoh. The baker was not in control of any of the elements on his job. He was passive in this dream. The baskets were on his head. The birds of prey were eating the food. And Joseph interprets the dream, and it wasn't what the baker expected. I wonder if the baker really believed him.
Regarding what Chip said,
yeah.
I think the cupbearer would have known if he had given that false interpretation to the baker, which would have undone all credibility, and he would have never mentioned it to the king.
Right. Oh.
Well, also the baker should have known better than that. This was a big problem because those birds were pooping
on his food, right? Yeah.
Food, yeah.
So, bluntly put in the text. Go ahead, Lee.
Just real quick observation. They were both put in at the same time. They were both released at the same time. Something happened between the two of them, and the Pharaoh finally figured out which one was at fault. And that's why they both came out at the same time. One happily.
So, yeah, one wonders what's going on behind the scenes, don't you? Yeah. As to why after 2 years they're let out. But bluntly put, the news that Joseph gave to the baker is that three things are going to happen. He's going to be decapitated, he's going to be impaled on a pole, and then the birds are going to eat his flesh for food. Not a pretty picture. There is something, by the way, particularly significant to the Egyptians. In their religion, their afterlife depended on the preservation of the body. Exposing a body to the elements and to birds of prey eliminates the possibility of a successful afterlife. So this is doubly devastating to the baker. This is a sentence of annihilation. Well, 3 days later it happens. Verse 20. It came about on the third day. It was Pharaoh's birthday. Well, what do you do on a birthday? Throw a party. And maybe the Pharaoh was feeling generous and kind. He held a feast for his servants. He lifted up the head of the chief cupbearer and the head of the chief baker among his servants. That is, he brought them into their presence and recognized them for what they had done. He restored the chief cupbearer to his office. He put the cup into the Pharaoh's hand, but he hanged the chief baker just as Joseph had interpreted to them. Yet the chief cupbearer did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. Joseph stands justified in both his interpretations. And you can be sure that the cupbearer knew it, as Rocky mentions this a few minutes ago. Yet he chose not to act. Perhaps the time was not convenient to bring up the matter to Pharaoh. Perhaps he was afraid that it would remind Pharaoh of the incident that put him in prison in the first place, and he didn't want to remind him of that. Whatever it was, whatever the reason, Joseph continues to languish in prison, a forgotten man. No one was acting on his behalf. Or better stated, no human was acting on his behalf. Though he had done no wrong, though he had told the truth, though he had specifically requested to be remembered, only silence prevailed. Joseph's long-awaited hopes were dashed. Talk about disappointment. Instead of being remembered and rewarded, he was forgotten for two more years. We know that from verse 1 of chapter 41, because two full years passed before Pharaoh had his dream. Two more long, monotonous, hard, difficult years after almost getting a reprieve. I begin this lesson by asking a question of how Joseph was able to deal with his unfair treatment. Unfair treatment that seemed to follow him wherever he went, family and foreigners alike. So I'm going to give you two thoughts this morning. Jace gives you one thing, I'm going to give you two. Not because I'm better, but because two works. First, what enabled Joseph to deal well with his unfair treatment was his absolute, unshakable confidence in the fact that God was with him in his suffering. Throughout this story about the Joseph narrative, we are reminded God was with him. God was with him. God was with him. God was with him. In the first instance, we're not surprised by that statement because God was with him when he organized Potiphar's household. But God was just as much with him when he was in prison, as we read earlier in chapter 39 at the end of that chapter. In chapter 40, no one could have had the confidence Joseph did that God was enabled to interpret dreams through him apart from an intimate walk with God in the dungeon. No one could have convinced the cupbearer unless there was evidence to be seen of that trust in God. So that when Joseph said, "Do not interpretations belong to God?" the cupbearer and the baker knew that Joseph was right. God was with Joseph, and Joseph had an unshakable, absolute confidence in God's presence. And what's true for Joseph, is true for you and for me. God promises to be with us. Hebrews 13:5, "I will never leave you. I will never forsake you. I will never desert you. I'm always with you." Romans chapter 8, nothing can separate us from the love of Christ. And he makes a list in that text of those things. And even when he sent the disciples out, what we give is the Great Commission, and as you go and as you make disciples and as you teach and as you baptize, do this because I am with you always. The promise of God's presence was given to Abraham, it was given to Isaac, it was given to Jacob, it was given to Joseph, it was given to Moses, to Joshua, to David, and throughout history. And I've stated this before, but since you only remember 10% of what I said anyway, and this might have been the 90% of what you forgot, I'll say it again. And if you remembered it, that's okay. It's good review. Spiritual growth, in a sense, is simply increasing our capacity to experience the presence of God. Spiritual growth, in a sense, is simply increasing our capacity to experience the presence of God. The more we are aware of, reflect upon, and grasp God's presence with us, the more likely we will live lives that honor him and be able to respond well to unfair treatment. Turn over in the New Testament, if you will, for a couple of illustrations. 1 Peter. 1 Peter chapter 2. I'm going to get there. I told you a couple weeks ago, I got this new Bible. Pages are still sticking together. 1 Peter chapter 2, this well-known text, beginning of verse 9, Peter says, "You're a chosen people. You're a royal priesthood. You're a holy nation. You're a people for God's own possession, so that you can proclaim the excellencies of him who called you out of darkness into his marvelous light. For you once were not a people, but now you are the people of God. You had not received mercy, but now you have received mercy." This is who you are, says Peter. Chosen, royal, holy, belonging to God. Then he begins to talk about what impact that has on how you live. "Therefore, I urge you, as foreigners and strangers, to abstain from fleshly lusts." But further on, verse 18, "Servants, be subject to your masters with all respect, not only to those who are good and gentle, but also to those who are harsh. For this finds favor if for the sake of conscience toward God a person endures grief when suffering unjustly. For what credit is there if when you sin you're harshly treated, you endure it with patience? But if when you do what is right and you suffer for it patiently endure it, this finds favor with God." One will never endure unfair treatment well if we don't know to whom we belong in the first place. That was Peter's point. This is who you are. Here are the implications of what that looks like. Joseph's ability to cope with unfair treatment was first of all found in his unshakable, absolute confidence in the presence of God in his life. Secondly, Joseph's ability to cope with unfair treatment is found in his selfless service to others instead of squandering his energies in self-pity. Verse 4, the captain of the bodyguard put Joseph in charge of them, and he took care of them. He ministered to them. Joseph could have smirked. Ha! So you thought you were special. You thought you had privilege in Pharaoh's court. And look, you did. You're no better off than I am. We're all in the same spot. Tough on you. But that wasn't Joseph's attitude, was it? He ministered to them. He cared for them. Their time in confinement, which for them had to be incredibly difficult. At least Joseph had some experience of being sold into slavery in the first place. These were men who had, in the court of Pharaoh, had incredible privilege and opportunity. So Joseph cared for them. Joseph saw his service wherever he was, whether in Potiphar's house or in prison, as ministry in the highest sense of that word. Not in the way that you and I would necessarily use the word as professional ministry, but as caring, as ministry, as being involved in the lives of other people. Centuries later, Caesar's household was reached with the good news of the gospel, but not in the way that Paul would have designed it had he been in charge. Turn back a few pages to Philippians chapter 1. Philippians chapter 1, verse 12. Now I want you to know, brothers and sisters, that my circumstances have turned out for the greater progress of the gospel, so that my imprisonment in the cause of Christ has become well known throughout the Praetorian Guard and to everyone else. Paul's imprisonment gave him opportunity to share the gospel. As one writer said, he had a captive audience because those guards who were watching over Paul were not allowed to leave. So he could preach all he wanted and they were going to have to sit there and listen. So.
Since Joseph didn't know Peter or Paul, he couldn't have. It seems logical that he was absolutely convinced of the dreams he had before he got sold into slavery.
Yeah.
and all this other stuff occurred. And that was what drove him in this experience. Yeah. Through Egypt and this dungeon.
Yeah, his confidence in what God had promised and his trust in that and willingness to follow through and continue to be a servant wherever he found himself. I mean, and James, in essence, tells us the same thing. He says, when you encounter various trials, value them. Don't think it's strange. Consider it. Matter of fact, he says, consider it joy. You're going, you're right. When you encounter these trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance, let endurance have its perfect result so that you may be complete, lacking in nothing. And if you lack wisdom about all of that, ask, but ask in faith, believing that God will hear you and respond and enlighten your heart and your soul in the midst of your unfair treatment. To better deal with unfair treatment, whenever it happens in whatever form it may come, if we can remind ourselves of Joseph and know with certainty that God is with you, and then continue to serve him and others, because God is always at work to accomplish his purposes. Got 2 minutes. Or you can go early. Not Varish, you ruined it.
There's a couple of comments. I once heard, I think, Chris Lawson, what he was talking about. God could be doing 1,000 things in your life, but at best, you may be aware of one or two of them. And because the intricacies of what he's doing is so much out of your scope of awareness. The second one I found was interesting. In verse 15, Joseph phrase when he says, I was in fact connected from the land of the Hebrews. It's like he understands the Abrahamic covenant.
Yes.
He doesn't say land of the Canaanites, he says land of the Hebrews. Now, in my mind, it's like he understands gives you what Jacob has told the family.
Yeah.
And they understand. I've always thought about how, you know, what Isaac may have told the boys, what Abraham told the boys, and what Jacob told the boys. And I kind of think it took. You kind of see some things taken here.
Yeah. Yep.
Again, sometimes the stories that we know well, and who of us haven't heard the story of Joseph being imprisoned and the interpretation of the dreams, are easily overlooked. And we forget the impact of who Joseph was and what that was designed to do for him and the principles that can help us in our everyday experience as well. No class next Sunday. Rocky's got you covered in 2 weeks. So let's pray together. Father, thank you. Thank you for the truth of your word, for the ministry of the Spirit, for the encouragement that you give to us through the characters that we see throughout Scripture. Thanks for Joseph. Father, continue to enlighten our understanding as we work through this series of the narrative of Joseph and the rest of Genesis, and encourage our hearts today that we might live for you despite our circumstances, because you're worthy. In Jesus' name, amen.